This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to Pacific Review from ABC Radio Australia. I'm Richard Ewart. Coming up, COVID-19 numbers rising in French Polynesia, but tourists are still free to visit. PNG's Bishop of Mendi, the catalyst behind the first ever International Day Against SARS, sorcery accusation-related violence. And stranded in Ghana, the Pacific Island doctor who just wants to go home. Those stories to come, but first, it's not been a good week on the coronavirus front in some parts of the Pacific, with COVID-19 re-emerging in New Zealand and numbers rising again in both French Polynesia and Guam. But most concern centres on Papua New Guinea, where the number of cases is approaching 300, and while most are still being registered in the capital, Port Moresby, numbers are growing in the provinces. The Ocatedi Gold and Copper Mine in Western Province is a hotspot, with 44 positive cases confirmed so far. The number of fatalities in PNG, though, is just 3, but there are dire predictions of thousands of COVID-19 deaths, and the government has reacted by drawing up plans for mass burials. But as Bethany Harriman reports from Port Moresby, in a country where mourning is a vital part of the culture, what impact would mass burials have on the traditional house cry?
Welcome to another edition of Beyond Boundaries on FM 100.
Officials will be closely monitoring them. Glenda Popot, FM 100 News, Port Moresby.
The name and voice of Glenda Popot had been long known in Papua New Guinea. The 37-year-old was a veteran journalist, but she recently died after a long battle with illness. The mother of 3 had spent 12 years working in television and radio, and was well-loved by her media colleagues. So a group of them attended Glenda's house cry, which literally translates to the house of crying in Tokpisin. It's the place where people gather to remember and mourn their loved one. But Glenda's house cry was unlike any they'd been before. TV journalist Tekla Gunga was one among them.
A curfew was imposed for everyone not to move around by 10 o'clock. We went up around 7 o'clock. And we had to leave at 9 o'clock. So we only had 2 hours to be with the family.
The government's COVID-19 measures include a nightly curfew. But house cries traditionally go on for days and through the night, with people often sleeping over. They're usually packed with relatives and friends, often hundreds at a time. But because of COVID-19, gatherings with more than 50 people are now banned, and people are required to keep 1.5 meters away from each other. Ms. Gunga says that made things difficult for the house cry, but they followed the rules.
Social distancing would be a problem, but for us, we are the people who write stories about all these things. You have to practice these measures.
Ms. Gunga says the COVID-19 restrictions have made it difficult to grieve.
So as much as all the media colleagues would want to be with our late colleague and sister, we couldn't do it during this period.
The often outspoken medical doctor, Professor Glenn Mola, who specializes in reproductive health, says house cries pose huge risks to the spread of COVID-19 in PNG.
So house cries are a very dangerous gathering. There's usually more than 10 people. The people come and go, so they bring stuff in, they take it back and spread it elsewhere. So there's a lot of movement of people in and out, and social distancing is not a focus, because we embrace each other, and it's a holding pass, and then usually the house cry, people are not satisfied with fist bumps. People don't wear masks because they consider it's a family event in the house or something. And then when you cry, then a lot of stuff comes out of your mouth more than if you're just breathing or speaking.
But Dr. Mola is urging people to adapt. And funeral homes also have to change the way they operate. Losa Agone is the general manager of a funeral home in Port Moresby and says it's been difficult to explain to grieving families.
You have some that don't understand, but you have some that understand. We're used to that, you know. It all happens. We try to understand their situation, you know. Plus, anyway, we also experience that too as well. ourselves.
They're having to ask that only 10 family members view the body at a time. Only 5 people will accompany the body during its preparation, while social distancing, washing hands and wearing a mask is mandatory. Deaths, of course, are a natural part of life. But Dr. Glenn Moller is warning there could be even more deaths to come because of COVID-19. He says, based on international experience during the global pandemic, up to 2,000 people may die from the virus in PNG in the coming months. The PNG government is planning for the worst-case scenario, allowing mass burials if it comes to that, which countries like Brazil and even the US city of New York have had to do.
Thousands upon thousands of graves are being dug at a cemetery in Sao Paulo.
Here's Glenn Moller explaining why.
There has to be some time limit on how long you leave your relative's body in the morgue, because the morgues are going to get fuller faster. Mm-hmm. When people start dying from COVID-19, when our epidemic really ramps up, we can't just leave our loved ones in the morgue for weeks and months.
But mass burials mean no house cry at all. That's something anthropologist Dr. Linus Digimrina says might be difficult, but he believes people can adapt.
It will certainly affect the PNG society in some ways, but putting off, calling off ritual obligations and practices is not unprecedented. The PNG custom is flexible enough. One thing our Melanesian culture prides on is it's a very dynamic culture. In other words, flexible enough to accommodate circumstances or crisis moments.
Dr. Digimrina says traditional leaders will play an important role and need to support the government's orders.
You know, people would like to continue with their normal life, but if a leader stands up and explains that such and such cannot happen today or tomorrow or for a week or a month, you know, people do listen. Yeah, especially voices of those leaders who have demonstrated leadership whereby they are trusted by the community.
UPNG anthropologist Dr. Linus Digimrina ending that report from Bethany Harriman in Port Moresby. More now on the situation in French Polynesia, where despite the rising number of second-wave COVID-19 cases, tourists are still being encouraged to visit the territory, with the president, Edouard Fritch, blaming the spike in cases on locals who have ignored social distancing protocols rather than tourists coming in from the USA and France. The government calls it a smart decision to keep the border open rather than risk further damage to the local economy. As the number of COVID-19 cases has continued to rise in French Polynesia, the people have been quick to point the finger at foreign tourists on social media, with comments like, "People's health is more important than the country's economy, economic activity can always resume its course unless we're all dead," and "We close everything and start again, total lockdown." And environmental consultant Vihir Wheeler posted a tweet saying, "Government trying to kill us for a couple of tourist bucks."
A lot of people were really angry because we had spent a lot of time in confinement, which was really hard for a lot of people because it was, I think, close to 2 months. And then we had gotten rid of COVID and everyone was moving around fine. And then shortly after that, they let us know that they were going to let in tourists, and not just any tourists, but tourists from California, from the U.S., which is one of the worst countries right now with COVID cases. So it feels like we're in confinement for nothing. It doesn't make any sense, really. It feels like we're disposable as a population.
Ms. Wheeler, who has been chosen as an Asia-Pacific leader for Tahiti by the Obama Foundation this year, concedes that the tourist industry has been doing it tough, but she believes the return of visitors from the US is not the way to go.
Some people were supportive of opening up borders, and those are people who work in tourism. I do actually know people who said, "Well, we need to live, we need to continue to work, and if we've lost our jobs, then what are we going to do?" I do understand that point of view, but that doesn't mean opening up the borders to California is the only option. And not only are people angry, but they're also confused about how to move forward. Just putting a mask on and keeping social distancing, which is like what they've been telling us the whole time, is not sufficient. and it's probably only going to get worse.
And those concerns would appear to have been validated within days of borders reopening, when the first new COVID-19 case emerged on the cruise ship Paul Gauguin. But Hironui Johnston, who advises the tourism minister, says that case is one of just two linked to tourism so far.
Among 10 imported cases, only two are registered as tourists. Those two has not infected anyone else. The first one was the American tourist who bought the Paul Gauguin. This shows that our protocols work because we have identified her, we have isolated her, and we have treated her.
Mr. Johnston also points out that all the other passengers on the Paul Gauguin were quarantined immediately for a week and tested twice, with no one giving a positive result. The president of French Polynesia, Edouard Fritch, is in no doubt over who's to blame for the re-emergence of coronavirus in the territory. His own people.
Aujourd'hui, je constate avec beaucoup d'amertume.
Today I am faced with a lot of bitterness that all our investments and sacrifices we have taken these last few days have gone up in smoke because of the irresponsibility of certain people.
But regardless of who is responsible, Vahir Wheeler, who lives on the island of Moorea, says she will think twice before taking a trip to Tahiti in the near future, and she feels for those people who have to travel to the main island for work.
Our main city, there's people moving everywhere, and it's a very busy city, and now I don't feel like I should be going into the different islands because I feel like I'm at risk to spread it. We have 118 islands, so a lot of outer islands are safe, and so now we have to rethink our whole way of living.
But the French ambassador for the territory, Dominique Seurat, speaking ahead of the president at a media briefing in Papeete, says there are no plans to shut the borders down again, and instead the focus will be on restricting social gatherings.
Nous ne voulons pas remettre en cause les mesures d'ouverture du territoire.
We don't want to speculate about the measures taken to open the territory. These were necessary to support the economic and social lives of the country. We also don't want to put the start of the school year back into question. This can only be done if we all take necessary precautions. We've decided all public gatherings of more than 50 people must submit an online declaration. All bars and nightclubs will be closed. They are sheltered environments where it's difficult to respect social distancing, and therefore are places where the virus can easily propagate.
Additional measures include the mandatory wearing of masks in public places and on all forms of transport, while restaurants will be required to ensure a 2-metre distance between tables. But Vahir Wheeler is still concerned that in its haste to reboot the economy, the government is still ignoring the risks attached to allowing tourists back in, and particularly those from the United States.
We don't have a lot of access to enough healthcare. We have one hospital for the whole territory, which is capable of supporting people who are affected by COVID. All the same issues are there before, but it seems like the government doesn't care as much. All the risks are still very high, but the government isn't paying attention to it.
Since the first case, we worked on the evolution of that protocol, adding more filters, adding more communication. And we think that we are doing a good job on that. Some of our neighboring countries said that we should have waited for New Zealand to open, but New Zealand and Australia are not our first market, and they wouldn't be able to compensate the loss of our first markets, which are Europe and North America.
But Bahia Wheeler, who has had to restructure her own consultancy business because of the impact of COVID-19 on the economy, remains to be convinced that letting tourists back in is the best way to fix the problem.
Well, the government hasn't really given enough support to a lot of people. Now their idea is to open up the borders and bring in tourism, but I don't even think that has made that big of an impact on the economy just yet. For the summer, we moved into consulting with nonprofits, and so it's been okay because we've been able to get grant funding to keep us afloat, but it does feel like everything is unknown for the rest of the year.
However, while the government may be sticking to their guns on allowing tourism to resume, Hironui Johnston says other Pacific countries with floundering tourist industries like Fiji and Vanuatu need to make their own decisions rather than follow French Polynesia's controversial example.
Our message to our neighboring countries is we had to take that risk. We have to find the right balance between health and social and economic, knowing that if we continue to stay in lockdown and to close our borders, at one point we wouldn't be able to continue to provide salary to everybody. At one point we will hit a social crisis that will cost us more than the health crisis. At one point, people wouldn't die of COVID-19. They would have died of hunger because they wouldn't be able to find food or to pay for food, and we wouldn't be able to help everybody at that time.
Hiranui Johnston, advisor to the tourism minister in French Polynesia. I'm Richard Ewart, and you're listening to Pacific Review. While the subject of violence against women has been high on the agenda in Papua New Guinea in recent weeks, the equally sensitive subject of attacks linked to allegations of witchcraft seems to have slipped into the background. However, Monday this week marked the first ever International Day Against Sorcery Accusation-Related Violence, an initiative driven by the Catholic Bishop of Mendi, Don Lippitt, up in the PNG Highlands. The provincial police commanders in the Southern Highlands and Enga province both have recent cases involving fatal attacks linked to accusations of sorcery on their books, but they say they lack the resources to pursue the perpetrators. The law has been changed in the recent past to make such attacks a capital offence, but Bishop Lippitt says the message is not getting through, and that's a key part of what an international day is all about.
We're experiencing even more cases, at least in our environment. And so we thought it was important to draw as much attention to the issue as we possibly can. And this first International Day Against Sorcery Accusation Violence is something that's being sponsored by a German Catholic mission society called Missio, but it's inspired by what we're doing in the Diocese of Mendi. The date that was chosen is the 10th, and that's the date that one of our survivors, Christina, was taken and tortured years ago. That's why they chose that date. And so this first International Day has a very local connection. And so we're taking advantage of that to draw as much attention to this issue as possible, because it's not going away.
And I note from the flyer that's been posted on social media and elsewhere that the photograph is of a female. You talk in the information there about the atrocity of the torture and killing of women and sometimes men accused of sorcery continuing. Now, my understanding is that in numerical terms, at least, that the number of attacks tend to be that there are more against men than women, but perhaps the cases against women are the more brutal and the more high profile.
Our experience is that it has been more women, but it is not unheard of that men would be also accused. We had a case recently, I think it was in the Lake Kutubu region, where three men were tortured and I think actually killed. But the experience that we've had of the nearly 100 cases, most of them have been women.
There is a national action plan that was put together some time ago. You were involved in that process, but to the best of my knowledge, it's still sitting in a drawer, isn't it?
Action plans are not good unless there's action behind it. Laws have been changed. If somebody is convicted of sorcery, accusation, violence that results in someone being killed, it's a capital offense, but nobody's ever been prosecuted on it. There's very few people at present who have been prosecuted with this crime. And until that starts happening, I don't think anything else is going to change. I think this is an effort, once again, just to turn the attention of people towards this issue and to start changing people's minds and behavior. As long as people can do these kinds of things with impunity, they're not going to change. And we have a further problem here with the whole issue, and that's that sometimes they deal with things in their own way, and that is to pay what they call compensation, and then there's no further legal proceedings. So you pay some money, and the people who have done this horrible atrocity get away with it.
How is the situation being complicated by the COVID-19 pandemic? This would seem to me to be, can I put it this way, the perfect excuse for those who would attack somebody on grounds of sorcery.
You speak very truly there. We have recently done a major outreach into the two provinces that make up our diocese, the Southern Highlands and the Hello Province. It included another outbreak of African swine fever that we've had here, especially in the Southern Highlands and the neighboring provinces where pigs are dying. And then on top of it, we included COVID-19 and a few other things. The connection is that if people start dying, or if pigs start dying, they will start pointing fingers at women especially and accuse them of sorcery. We've tried to do some kind of an awareness, trying to stave that off, but the immediate thinking when unexpectedly people start getting sick or pigs start getting sick, it's somebody is doing this to us through sorcery, and then they start looking and starting pointing fingers, and then the whole macabre spectacle begins. It's a terrible atrocity just to think of what happens to these women and men, and it's something that is just intolerable, and it has to stop now.
That's the Catholic Bishop of Mendi in the PNG Highlands, Don Lippitt, talking about the first ever International Day Against Sorcery Accusation-Related Violence. And finally, for the past 2 months, 25-year-old Moses Dame from Chimbu Province in PNG has been stranded on the other side of the globe. He's stuck in the West African country of Ghana and desperate to raise the money to pay for a seat on an Australian charter flight out. As Evan Wasuka reports, Moses' family are praying he'll make it back home safely and soon.
As a young boy growing up in Papua New Guinea, Moses Dame always wanted to dedicate his life to medicine.
He was a small boy in school and I saw him Ben Carson's DVD on the brain operation of the twins.
And the blood flow is disrupted. The twins' brains will swell and hemorrhage.
He was passionate about that.
That's his father, Joey Dame.
So that's where his passionate grew and he wants to be a doctor in becoming a neurosurgeon.
Moses graduated as a doctor in the city of Kumasi in Ghana in June. And life was looking pretty good for the new doctor. He posted this Facebook video to family and friends.
Actually, today I've removed my white coat and my stethoscope, packed them in my bag because it's time to go home. And I've got to go to Nigeria first, take a trip from Nigeria to Dubai, from Dubai to Cairns, Australia.
But his plan to travel by bus into Nigeria fell apart with Ghana tightening its borders. With all international flights cancelled, Moses found himself locked down in Ghana, but abandoned by the school he just graduated from.
After the graduation, the hospital kicked us out of the premises, so we have to look for our own place. I came to live with one of my friend, whom we did like internship together, and I was able to rent one of the place in their home.
As the son of missionary parents, Moses paid his own way through 5 years of medical school in China. Then he traveled to Ghana for a one-year practical at a training hospital associated with his Chinese university. He settled into his new life in Africa and linked up with the Seventh-day Adventist community. Now, as he waits for an international flight out, Moses says his faith has helped him cope with the uncertainty.
I just want to go home. You know? Looking through my window every day, it felt like a prison. Like, I'm no different to a prisoner. Like, was waiting for his date to be released and he would walk out free. Like, I'm just waiting to go home. Like, that's all I could think of. Yeah.
17,000 kilometers away in PNG's highlands town of Koroka, Moses Dame's father has also been anxious the past few weeks.
It's been a while and I'm feeling a bit down and I desperately need him to come home after his graduation online. And I'm a bit worried about him to the kind of the situation that we are currently in. We want to get him out and he will serve not only in Papua New Guinea, but other parts of the world as well, if there is needed in that particular area. So his desperate need to come home.
Friends, too, are worried. Lisa Areka met Moses in China when she studied there. She returned home in February as the coronavirus pandemic gripped the world. She's worried about Moses and says he's putting on a brave face for family and friends.
I've been chatting with him and he said he's getting in touch with those embassies, so he will be fine. Yeah. From there to here is too far and it's very expensive.
Moses did recently get some good news from the Australian High Commission in Ghana about a charter flight that they're organizing for mostly Australian citizens. His travel documents are ready, stamped and approved by the PNG High Commission in London. But the way out comes with a hefty price tag, one that's out of reach for the unemployed doctor and his missionary parents.
The flight is from Ghana to London. They have a standard cost like $2,500, which will be equivalent to like 9,000 to 10,000 PNG kina. And then from UK, I have to fly from Stansted Airport in UK to Brisbane and then Brisbane to PNG. So the cost from there would probably take me up to like 20, 21,000 somewhere there.
But the 20,000 kina, that's around 8,000 in Australian dollars, hasn't dissuaded his parents. They've started an appeal to raise the money, but they're on a tight deadline.
The next flight, I've received an email today that the next flight will be on 28th of this month, but the payment of the ticket and the registration will be on 11th of August. Yeah, 11th of this month. So I have to register with them, like sign some forms and fill the other online links on 11th, before 11th. So hopefully the 14th will be the due date.
Mr. Dame Senior isn't fazed by the looming deadline.
Yes, I'm still trusting God and have confidence, and there are few responses coming, and there are people who have seen the flyer, they have been responding and doing contributions. So I'm hoping that before the 14th, we should be closest to the target. Yeah.
That's Joe Adame, who's running an appeal to bring his son back home from Ghana. And the reporter there was Evan Wasuka. And that's it from this edition of Pacific Review. I'm Richard Hewitt, and as always, thanks for your company.